Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Remember the times, a simpler time. And, of course, the Winter Olympics. We all remember 1980 and where we were when the U.S. won the gold medal. It was a time that will live forever. Dr. Bill Baker was a part of that team. And every 4 years, at least, I call him to do this interview because it's so much fun to do. But today I was a little bit stifled because I had his office number and I called him and they said, Bill's not here anymore. He retired. And I said, no, it's not possible that Bill retired because he was just flying down the ice for Team USA. How did this happen? But Bill, they were right. You are no longer a practicing dentist, or at least on an everyday basis, huh? Oral surgeon?
Right, right. Yeah, I retired about 2 years ago, actually. You're right. You know, I don't talk to anybody for 4 years. You know, time flies.
Yeah.
Yes, I've been already retired now 2 years. So, yeah.
Did you always know you wanted to be a dentist? Was that something you knew as soon as your hockey career was over, before it was over?
I kind of knew that. Yeah, even when I was recruited at the U, I got to know Norm Holte real well, and he was an oral surgeon at the U, and was kind of my goal all along was to get into oral surgery if I could, you know, go the dental route, and really enjoyed what he did and watching them and getting to know some of those guys at the U, and then just kind of took off from there. And after I was done playing hockey, I knew it was going to be a long haul to get there with dental school for 4 years and then a 4-year residency. But I did it, and it was well worth it, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, I mean, was there a correlation there between obviously hockey and teeth being knocked out? Did that create the fascination at all?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, early on, I saw a couple of kids in my neighborhood, you know, lose their teeth and break their jaws down at the local rink, and I thought, you know, who fixes that? You know,
yeah.
You know, so I kind of got started that way, and then as you saw, you know, more things as you got a little older and farther along in the game, it certainly there was some correlation, and then I thought I'd like to, you know, to treat the trauma and do the jaw surgeries and broken jaws and things like that. So, yeah, there was definitely a correlation.
So an oral surgeon does obviously teeth and then jaws, and what else? What else right. would be a typical surgery for you?
Our big surgeries are where we would move either the upper or lower jaw, either forward or back, depending on what needed to be done, you know, to correct a dental facial deformity. And then, you know, a lot of trauma if you elect to do that. There's, you know, different things you can specialize in, and it kind of holds the whole gamut. You know, there's some cosmetic things you can do. That wasn't a big part of my practice, but we're kind of more of the blue collar kind of nuts and bolts, I guess I'd call it, oral surgery practice.
It sounds like it was a fulfilling career, though.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was definitely challenging at times, but I did. I enjoyed it. A great partner when I came up here, a good opportunity here in Brainerd, and we had offices in Bemidji, Little Falls, and Detroit Lakes, and so we have to do a little traveling, but I sure enjoyed it. And you know, what's rewarding is the patients, and plus getting to know all the general dentists, you know, who are basically the referral base for your practice, and getting to know all of them, and made some real nice friendships.
Yeah, that's fun stuff. Let's go. This year, of course, it's Russia against the U.S., but it's different. How do you feel? I can't get my arms around what this USA hockey team is this year because it's this kind of combination, and it's they're pros, but they're not NHLers, and they weren't under contract even if they played in the American League. Do you like the way it's set up this year?
You know, I kind of agree with you. It didn't really sneak up on you, but it just seems like you don't really know, you know, what it was going to be until the NHL decided for sure last year that they weren't going to send players. And so then all of a sudden it became kind of a scramble, I think, for them to figure out who was it going to be, you know. And so, you know, some of the names you've heard, but most you haven't, which is exactly like 1980, but they are professionals. The majority of them are professional players that maybe have some NHL experience or played over in Europe. Or in the American League or whatever. So it's just a little hard for me, too. I really don't know much about them or know the players that are on the team.
Take me back to 1980 in terms of just making the team. Did you have a pretty good idea from the outset that, that you would be there, or was it pins and needles for most guys throughout?
Well, you know, I guess it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to all the guys from Minnesota that had played for Herb, it was pins and needles right to the bitter end. But, we kind of had heard some rumblings about, you know, maybe some people were, you know, guaranteed spots or whatever. But none of us knew that. I remember even going in to question Herb because I'd been accepted into dental school and I thought, geez, well, maybe just give me some kind of an inkling. And he basically didn't even want to talk to me about it. It was just like, you know, couldn't give me any kind of an indication. So what I did was I put dental school on hold and thought I had a pretty good chance and turned them down. And then I thought I had a pretty good chance of making the team. But you didn't really know. Even at the sports festival in the summer where the top 26 were picked, I mean, they read your name off in the group. You know, all 80 players that were at that tournament are standing there, and they read off 26 names. And you talk about nerve-wracking.
So
and, you
know, 80 guys and 26 will be left, huh?
Right. Yep.
And obviously, these are pretty good 80 players.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody did, you know, they did things, you know, something well. You know, there's a reason why they were there. And so it's like, yeah. And I remember when, you know, the relief when they read your name off, you know, but it's just kind of weird, you know. I mean, there's a lot of good players in that room.
Bill, how was Herb different as a coach at the university versus when he coached that team? Was the relationship the same? Did he treat you the same as he did when you were a Gopher, or was it different?
He treated me pretty much the same all the way through. I had him, you know, 4 years at the U, a year with the Olympic team, and a year in New York. And you know, I think you could probably count the time Herb and I talked, well, maybe on one hand.
Really?
It's crazy. But I have nothing but the utmost respect for him, what he did for me as a hockey player. But I wish I could have gotten to know him as a person, you know. I mean, it's just Phil Bercota is one of my best friends, and Mike Ramsey, and we talk a lot, you know, especially Phil and I who had Herb for – you know, Phil had him for 5 years. I had him for six, but we talk about, you know, just wish maybe one time he would let his guard down just to, you know, to talk to you, you know, kind of man to man and just say, I can't believe you let me do that to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't believe you let me work you like that. But I knew you guys would, but I can't believe, you know, but it was, you know, just the way it was. He kept it real businesslike, and all you wanted, all you cared was that your name was on the lineup sheet for the next day, you know?
Yeah, Mike Ramsey said to me once, he said, when Herb passed, he said, the one thing I wish is, I wish he would have told me what he saw in me and why he put me on the team. What did he really see in me that maybe I couldn't even see in myself? And that sounds like, you should know what he saw. But I get that. You know, he didn't, you just wanted to know why me and not, because you probably saw a lot of other good players that didn't make the team.
Oh, definitely. And same with at the U. When I was a senior in high school, I mean, I was recruited by, you know, lots of colleges, but I knew I wanted to go to the U. And I remember, you know, I would wait for that envelope with the big gold M on it. And when Herb would be in the building to watch, and we had, you know, John Rossi was on my team in high school, was one of the best high school players in Minnesota history, I think, in my opinion.
Yep.
And we had lots of scouts there all the time. Well, you know, when Herb was in the building, it was just a different thing for me. But so when he said he was going to recruit one defenseman to the University of Minnesota that year, and if Baker didn't come, he wasn't going to recruit any. I mean,
wow.
That was it. He might as well put that letter of intent right in front of me right then, because I would have signed it. You know what I mean? That's what I waited for. It was the same with the Olympic team. You know, there's so many good players. Like you say, you just kind of wonder, you know, and Herb had a special way. I think when he, even with the way he recruited, he just didn't always pick the flashiest, you know, prettiest players, but he knew kind of their personalities and how hard he could work them. And if they had some talent, he could do something with them. I think that's the way he looked at it. Maybe not so much with the Olympic team, maybe just picked more on talent. But when at the U, I mean, it seemed like he was able to mix players and he knew how to do that. He was a master at that.
When you played Russia in you know, the most famous hockey game maybe in the world from the U.S. standard, did you remember going into that game? Was there a feeling of confidence? Was there a feeling, or was it just, hey, let's see if we can get one goal and go from there? Do you remember anything in particular that was prevailing about that game?
You know, it's funny, you're taxing my memory. It's funny, we always laugh because we say we're fishing or whatever we're doing. We say, wish we had, if we knew we were going to be talking about this.
If you knew we'd have won it, we'd have paid more attention, huh?
I would have taken more notes. I would have taken notes. I mean, you know, it's hard to remember, but the things that you do remember, You know, the Russians had kind of embarrassed us 2 weeks earlier in New York. And I think now on this bigger stage, and we'd gotten through that, we all kind of just didn't want to embarrass ourselves. And we knew what we were going to have to do to stay in it, you know, and what kind of an effort it was going to take. And so I remember being really nervous before that game, you know. And, well, and same with the Finn game, being very, very nervous about it because, you know, I didn't want to let that one get away either, you know. But with the Russians, it was more, yeah, you just knew you couldn't make mistakes. You know, they would capitalize so easy on a mistake.
Well, and as a defenseman, you must have been skating backwards going, oh, my God, here they come, huh?
Oh yeah. There were some of them. It was unbelievable. You know, you'd watch them. You could sneak in to get into a practice to watch the Russians, or I'd try to sneak in, and you can see, watch some of the other European teams practice, and you'd wonder how you could ever be on the same ice sheet with them. You know, it was just crazy.
Do you remember going into the third period, what you're thinking when you knew you were that close?
Yeah, we thought we were going to try to, you know, we weren't getting many shots, so we're going to have to make it count if we got one. You know, got a good opportunity, and it just happened on Ruzioni's goal to go ahead. We were slow on a line change or something. If you look at it, I'm going to the net, and I actually put my stick down. It's almost like I went to tip it.
Yeah.
And the Ruzioni shot wasn't a blistering shot. It just went in. And it was like, I couldn't believe it. And I'm right about at the net as when it goes in, and it was crazy, you know.
You mean you almost had a chance to tip it, the next thing you knew it was just in the net, huh?
I told Riz, if I didn't say anything about a year later, you should have seen his face. I said, Riz, I've never told anybody, but... You know, I think I got a piece of that one. You know, I mean, he turned white.
That would change the banquet circuit for him in a hurry,
oh,
wouldn't
my
it?
God, yeah, they, all of a sudden they'd have a Midwesterner on that.
After you won that game and you had to focus now on winning gold, what do you remember about that? How did you come down from that? Or did you do something immediately after the game? Did Herb do anything to make sure the focus went right back?
No, not really. You know, it's funny because We practice. It seemed like we played every other day, you know. So we'd play a game, practice, play another game, practice, and so there really wasn't that much time, which was fortunate. And plus, we were kind of shut in Lake Placid, and it seemed like.
Oop! Did we lose you, Bill? Go ahead. Go again. We just lost you there for a second. Yeah, it seemed like we lost you right after you were explaining how you prepared for that final game.
Yeah, you know, I guess we really didn't have a whole lot of time to think about it. You know, we had, you know, a day of practice, and then but really didn't do anything different. But, you know, it just seemed like we really, I guess, wasn't reading the paper, really. My parents were there, so I really didn't have much contact with anybody else. So I really didn't know what was going on outside of Lake Placid, which was probably the best thing that could have happened, you know. So...
Were you celebrated quite a bit inside the village as you won games from the other Olympic athletes, or did it not really mean anything until you won gold?
I don't think it really meant anything until we won gold. You know, it really didn't seem like, I mean, we were getting, you know, we had quite a following, but it wasn't, that place only really held like 7,000 people or something. And, you know, we've been sold out for a while. Everybody wanted to watch all the other teams.
Sure.
Well, I don't think it was because of us, but. But, you know, it's one of those things. It's funny. We laugh, too, because everybody says, yeah, I've had about 15, 20,000 people tell me they were at the game against the Russians. I said, well, it only holds 7,500 people, you know. So, anyway, but, you know, so, yeah, it was just kind of a crazy time. I don't remember, even in the village and that, I don't remember a whole lot of, you know, attention on us or anything. You know, it's just kind of like, just it seemed like.
That's the hockey team, and over here's the curling team, whatever, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and here's, you know, here's Eric Heiden, here's the Mayer brothers, here's, you know, Ty Babylonia, Randy Gardner, here's all the, you know, here's everybody else, but we were still kind of an unknown.
When you won it and you went to the White House, did it hit you then? Did you have any idea how long what the shelf life would be on this and what had really happened? I mean, was it easy for you guys to process that? Because remember, too, I mean, you got to take note of this was pre-social media, so you didn't know immediately how everybody felt about it.
Yeah, no, I still had no idea. Like I said, I don't think it really sunk in till a lot longer afterwards. It just didn't seem like, you know, at that point we knew that. I mean, obviously, probably some people did, but I guess I really didn't think of it that way. I had no idea that we'd be talking about it still, like I say, 38 years later.
When you got done at the White House, I've seen the movie or I've read the book, whatever it was, and you get to a juncture there where you're, it's kind of like you're free to go now. It's over. Mm-hmm. You've done it. Right. And you can go do whatever you want. What do you remember about that experience, looking at everybody and going, you know, maybe starting to understand you'd be bonded for life but from this experience, but all of a sudden it's like we've gone through this amazing process. We've loved and hated our coach. We've gone, only we understand what we went through. And now you're looking at each other and going, well, hopefully I'll see you sometime. Do you remember that moment or what that was like?
Not really remember it. I guess we, you know, everybody was kind of thinking ahead because we really weren't expected to win.
Sure.
You know, everybody was kind of thinking ahead, and there was probably 6 or 8 players that had, you know, professional contracts kind of waiting. You're waiting to make that jump. As soon as it was over, you knew you were going to go. But, of course, if you'd have known you're going to win a gold medal, you'd have said, I'm not going to sign until maybe the summer or something.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah, you get to that point where it's like, but you know, there's so many Minnesota guys that, you know, we'd played together for more than a couple of years. And so
yeah.
It's kind of like any other year, sort of, you know. But on the other hand, yeah, you thought you may not be around the other guys too much from here on out. You know, it was kind of a time you just had to kind of say goodbye and here we go. We'll see you wherever.
What were your impressions of Neil Broughton at that time?
Well,
could you see what he had in front of him?
Well, Neil's a good friend, and
yeah.
We were just up ice fishing. I took him up. We went up ice fishing about a month ago, and I've known him since. And he was kind of a legend before he even knew it. You know,
yeah.
Everybody knew who Neil Broughton was in northern Minnesota. I remember when he was a peewee. I think I was a first year band, and he was a peewee, probably playing up from squirts or whatever. His jersey was down about mid-shin, you know, he was kind of little, but he could dangle even back then, and you could just tell he was head and shoulders above the other kids, you know, and then he came to the U, and he just, you know, those guys that are like Neil and those, you know, guys, they just have it, you know.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where they've just got it, and you can just tell from the first day of practice, they've got it.
Yeah, and he's so doggone humble that I think you're right, I don't think he even realizes to this day what he had.
Oh, yeah, just funny. Too bad he can't catch more fish. I don't know. But he was a heck of a hockey player. No, I'm kidding. He'll be all over me.
I'm going to coach against him next week in a charity game. I'll remember that. Hey, Dr. Baker, right. We appreciate it very much. Congratulations, delayed on your wonderful career as a dentist and oral surgeon. But I really appreciate it. It's just so fun to relive it every time we get a chance.
Yes, I suppose we'll talk to you in 4 years, huh?
Yeah, I'll talk to you in 4 years.
Right.
Thanks, Dr. Baker.
Right.
Bill Baker, 1980 Miracle on Ice. We could have somebody on every night from that team, I think, and it would be worth listening. I'll take a break, come back. Welcome back, Sports to Max News Radio, 830 WCCO. Tune in to the high school sports rally tonight. I'll be joined by Frank Bastolero. Highlights of 7 different high school games, Edina and Blake and girls hockey. Blake moved up a class. That'll be kind of fun. An interesting piece in a young man in Apple Valley High School who was adopted from Columbia. He's now ranked 3rd in the state at the 132-pound weight class. His mother and his brother are both cancer survivors. David McCoy will bring us that story. We also spent time at the state dance competition today at Target Center, and we'll have something from there as well. That's all tonight at 10:20 on the High School Sports Rally on WCCO-TV. How much fun it is to do that. When we come back, speaking of high school, Larry McKenzie's the high school coach, number 1 ranked Minneapolis North in Class 2A. He also can speak to a number of different things, including he took his team to the Black Panther movie last night for, you know, he's got an inner city and African-American team. Be interesting to see why he did it and what they got out of it. Stay with us. This is Sports to the Max. This is WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back, Sports to the Max. Not often on a Friday night you can get over a high school basketball coach. Minneapolis North happens to have the night off, number 1 ranked team in Class 2A. They moved up a class, just like we were talking about Blake did in hockey, and they beat Minnehaha Academy earlier this year. What was that game like, Larry? Because that was much anticipated for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, both teams look forward to it. I mean, it was a really, really good high school game. I mean, a good crowd. I mean, two extremely talented teams. I mean, and they went out and we battled. It wasn't an up and down kind of game that people thought, more of a defensive game, and we were able to come away with the victory.
Until we meet again, as they say, right?
Until we meet again, yes, sir.
Hey, how's Isaac Johnson doing? Great player, went on to Western Illinois.
Isaac is doing great. Actually, I was sitting here tomorrow. He's playing at South Dakota State, thinking about maybe trying to make that drive over to Brookings tomorrow morning after practice.
Sure.
So to see him play. But Isaac is in the starting lineup.
Really?
The team is playing about .500 right now. Had a good preseason. They struggled a little bit in the summit in the conference. But Isaac is had his career high two nights ago, 23 points. So
really?
Playing about 27 minutes a game.
Could you see that in you? I mean, you guys had so many players that did so many things well. Did you think he'd be able to step in and play right away?
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the things, Mike, not necessarily bragging, but, you know, I all the time, my kids, all of the kids over the years, all of my kids have actually gone on to either start as freshmen or play significant minutes. So, you know, I know that they're prepared at that level. And, you know, we've done some things to help them be ready to play at that level. So they go and they fit in. They do pretty good. So I'm not surprised at all.
What was it like for Lawrence when he went down to Oklahoma? Because in the Big 12, what was that like right away?
Well, you know, again, I mean, I think Lawrence started. He was a six-man for a while, and then he started. And, you know, he led his freshman year, he led the Big 12 in three-point shooting.
Did he?
You know, yeah, played, yeah. So, yeah. Both years there, I mean, he played significant minutes. So, you know, just got a little homesick to end up coming back. But, yeah, wasn't because he wasn't playing. So,
Larry, you took your team to the Black Panther last night, which is a movie that's created a lot of buzz right now. And it's also Black History Month. But take me back. Why did you take them there? What's the movie about, and what did you get out of it?
So for me, Mike, you know, we're always trying to educate our kids on and off the court. And so I thought it was a great opportunity. You know, the movie was about one of the superhero Marvel comic, you know, Black Panther, primary black cast takes place in Wakanda, a country in Africa that is highly advanced. It was just a great story. I tell you, man, I enjoyed the movie so much that if I didn't have you scheduled tonight, I'd be watching it again tonight.
It's that good, huh?
It was that good. I mean,
and you're not a cartoon kind of animated kind of guy.
And not at all. Didn't know, you know, I tell people I didn't know anything about the, you know, other than the Superman, Batman kind of stuff, but not really follow, you know, comics like that. But no, it was just a really really good story. Lots of, I'd say, tweetable lines in the movie, some good lessons. I mean, you know, some wrongs being righted, you know, the importance of giving, the importance of believing in the right thing. It was just a really good movie. But more importantly, any time for me, for our kids to have an opportunity to see something positive, and have, you know, this was a superhero that looked like them. So I just thought it was a great opportunity for us. So.
So when you converse with your kids after that, what do you find that they got out of it?
Well, they were really, really excited. I mean, you know, honestly, so they were more Marvel comic fans than me. And so they were just kind of trying to school me on, you know, where the Black Panther fit in with all of it, and something, I don't know, some kind of the lady, somebody's going to be united and whatever. So they knew a lot more about what was going on than I did. But because, you know, there is some references to some of the other superheroes in there as well. So, but it was just, I just tell you, the movie, if you appreciate good cinematography and all of that kind of stuff, I mean, it was really good. So great costumes, all of that good stuff.
Many years ago, I was at the museum in Washington, D.C., and we were taking a tour of it. And they had the portion of the exhibit on slavery. And as we walked in, there was a bunch of, I'd say, fourth or fifth graders, African-American kids that were in some respects, for the first time, seeing what it was about. And it was graphic and in detail. And some of them had tears in their eyes and were tearing up when they saw this display. And I thought, my gosh, this is the first time that they realized this ever existed. This is Black History Month, Larry. Yeah, and that's what I'm getting. With your team, do they have a great sense of Black History Month and what that means?
Yeah, you know, but the one thing that we try to emphasize for our kids, I mean, you know, not really get caught up into, honestly, the 29 days of February where Black History Month is celebrated, that it's about celebrating all the time. And so, you know, we bring in business people and speakers every week that look like them. So, you know, all the way from November through March. So, and it's always about exposing them to successful people that look like themselves. And, you know, I mean, one of the things I think is always important for our kids to see, you know, that other folks who've overcome trials and tribulations and those kinds of things and still been able to make it. And if they can, you can. And so we really don't get caught up into the celebration of, you know, like I said, just February as Black History Month. It's something that we do on a regular basis.
And that's even, not, you know, that's, you know, not really so a racial, like, thing either, is it, Larry? I mean, anybody can overcome to get somewhere, you know, and many people have
absolutely
to.
Absolutely. Oh, it's universal.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, that's probably every successful person that we've ever heard of, regardless of race, creed, or color. You know, I mean, you've had to overcome something. I mean, and that, to me, that's always, I tell the kids anyway, that's what separates the good from the great. Because, you know, a lot of folks have great ideas and those kind of things, but when it gets tough, they throw in the towel.
Yep.
So that's part of, you know, yeah, it's not about the race at all. So, but, you know, even when we took the trip to Chicago, you know, we took our kids during Martin Luther King Day. We, you know, they got a chance to visit Malcolm X College and, you know, participate. They got a chance to watch a video on John McClellan, the first African-American coach that, you know, kind of crossed the color lines and the impact that he had on basketball. So we try to do a lot of educating our kids about some of the positive things of African-American heritage.
You know, and when you say that, when you talk about overcoming, we don't think of this, the guy I'm about to mention, as overcoming it, because we've been so comfortable with him as being a great basketball player for so long. But to absolutely think that a 5'9", somewhat rotund guy could be a point guard that leads his team to a national championship, named Khalid El-Amin. He is now an assistant coach with you and a nephew or son on the team. I mean, when you look at him, we forget, don't we, that, I mean, as great as he is as a player, that's not the profile of what you're supposed to be that great, are you?
Absolutely right. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, if you look, particularly these days, I mean, if you look at, you know, how the kids are defined and to be able to play at this level or that level. No, he didn't meet the profile. And so that, I mean, again, that in itself is important, having him on the staff. You know, here's a guy, you know, walked the same streets to school, walked the same hallways, practiced in the same gym, went to the same locker room, all of that kind of stuff. And, I mean, and, you know, boy, what a magical career. You know, 3 state titles here. You know, led his team to a national title. I mean, a long-term professional career, played a little bit in the NBA, but definitely, you know, overseas, a number of MVPs. So, yeah, it can be done. You know, yeah. You know, it's a lot. It has shows a lot about your heart and your desire to do something. So,
How do you teach a kid like he did to see the game, to see the court that way? Is that a lot of pickup basketball where you just got to experience it, or can you teach some of that?
You know what, Mike? I mean, to be honest with you, I think we talked about this the last time we had an opportunity. I think it's just a gift. I mean, some guys are just more blessed than others, and that's a gift. I mean, I don't think, you know, the ability to see the court and play and the leadership, I don't think that's something that you sit down in the classroom or any coach, you know, in terms of X's and O's and that kind of stuff. It's really a gift. I mean, and we got a young man right now, I mean, Trajan Holloman, I mean, who is definitely following in Khalid El-Amin's footprints. I mean, he's an eighth grader who's starting for us, who's very, very talented, and I mean, just you know, has an innate ability to get out there. I mean, to play the game at a different level than most 13-year-olds that you see around. So,
how did you have the guts to say this kid's ready to play with the big guys here? Was that hard to do?
You know, it is. I mean, and so the first thing I was worried about whether or not the physicality of it, would he be able to handle it? But just kind of being around him, I mean, it doesn't take long, you know, to see. I mean, he's actually one of our leaders, team leaders. I mean, always very vocal in any meetings that we have and those kind of things. And so, you put guys out there to compete, and you know, I just tell them all the time, regardless of grade, if you're ready, we're going to put you out there. And he's had an outstanding eighth grade year. But, I mean, you also go back, you know, Odell Wilson is now a fifth-year starter for us.
Is he a five-year starter, too?
He's a five-year, yeah. He's been starting.
Oh, he's a nice player, nice football player, too, of course.
Yeah, yes, he is. Yeah, great athlete and a great student.
Yes. Yes, and he does a lot of things well over there. I met him a couple of different times, and you can just tell when you meet him that there's a maturity about him.
Yeah, impressive young man. Yep. So, yeah, he's a – I was teasing him last night because I was telling him, you know, coach, been coaching a long time, haven't had my first fifth-year starter.
Wow. Even your great teams at Henry, nobody played in the eighth grade, did they?
No eighth graders that played. No, not like that. No, not at all.
Yeah, I mean, you got to really be special that way. Well, now, you're an expert at this. It's February. You're heading towards March. What do you want to get out of your team right now over the next couple of weeks as you prepare for the playoffs?
Well, you know, the thing of it right now, we're just trying to manage, make sure everybody stays healthy, you know, keep their legs fresh. You know, we're not trying to do a whole lot of different things. But really right now, you spend a lot of time kind of watching film, just trying to fix things. So a lot of it right now, it's like, you know, preparing for that final exam. You know, you're just kind of really, really
tweaking,
you know, tweaking things and going through and making sure kids understand, you know, what you want them to be doing defensively, offensively, and those kind of things. And so, yeah. And the main thing is just try to stay lucky and stay healthy.
In other words, it's a really fun time of the year for you, isn't it?
Loving it. Yes.
Well, Larry, we appreciate it very much. Always appreciate having you on. And, of course, you and I will be in touch over the next couple of weeks. But always fun to watch Minneapolis North and always fun to talk to you about a number of different topics.
Yes, sir. And I appreciate it. Yeah, I always appreciate you reaching out to us. So.
You bet. Larry McKenzie, a coach and a friend from the North Side. Take a break. Come back. Al Malmberg will give us a preview. The Maplewood Toyota time is 8:48. Welcome back, Sports to the Max. Al Malmberg is sitting out in Colorado waiting to bring us. It's Friday, so it's Aviation Friday and much more. Al, how are you tonight?
I am doing great. Speaking of the world of aviation tonight, John Hansen is coming back on, and this is one of the most remarkable events in aviation history, in my opinion. John was the pilot in command, senior pilot, senior captain, 747 heading over to Japan from Detroit. And on overseas flights on 747s, they would have two crews. They were over the Bering Sea about, 4 something in the afternoon when they had a hard over rudder, Mike.
Uh-huh.
And because of the quick action of the pilot, this plane was saved. And both crews, they alternated at the controls, fighting to keep this plane.
What does that mean, a hard over rudder? What does that mean?
The plane tried to roll over upside down. You've heard of the 737s. There were two of them. One crashed just south of Colorado Springs probably 20-some years ago.
Uh-huh.
No, about 25 years ago now. Another one, the same thing happened at Pittsburgh coming in for a landing.
What causes that?
Mechanical malfunction. Fortunately, on a 747, they have what is called a split rudder. So the upper part of the rudder remained, in the position it should be in. The lower went to a hard over, which is, it's trying to roll the plane over. It's trying to turn the plane. So here they are at 35,000 feet. They're flying along, and suddenly they go into a 40-degree bank before the pilot in command was able to wrestle it back. And you know, Randy Sohn, a good friend of ours, he made the statement before I interviewed John Hansen the first time that it's a good thing Mrs. Hansen's little boy, Johnny, was at, you know, on
yeah.
the plane because 400 lives were saved.
Wow.
But they had to alternate about every 10 minutes, I think he said, because it just wore them out. Manhandling
physically,
this behemoth airplane.
How do you find fighting. All these guys? Yeah, they've all got incredible stories.
Yeah, you know, it's just there's a lot of incredible people out there. But John, I was so Greg Benson from the Wings of the North Air Museum at Flying Cloud Airport in Eden Prairie told me they've got a Pathfinder speaker series, and John is going to be the speaker tomorrow at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I said, boy, I should get him on the show back on
sure.
the show. And John has become a good friend over the years. And I called him and he said, yeah, let's do it.
Wow.
So we're going to have him on. And you know, we're going to talk about that the Flight 85 out of Detroit to Narita Airport in Tokyo, Japan. And how, you know they had to, they didn't know if they could keep the plane in the air, Mike. And
wow.
So they very gradually, turned the plane to go to Anchorage, Alaska. They diverted to Anchorage. And, that took some time. And then they had to figure out, okay, can we land this thing?
Well, Al, in that situation, is there ever a point in time where you would try to, and I'm just speaking from the outside looking in, where you try to run it low along an ocean or a body of water until you ran out of gas because that would be a softer landing, or does that not work?
No, the last place you want to put a plane is in the water.
No matter what?
No matter what. That's the last place. I mean, that's why Sullenberger was,
yeah.
They call it the miracle on the Hudson. That was just miraculous. I mean, it was a miracle. It was unbelievable how he was able to do that. But you want to find a place to land where you can land the plane intact. That's the optimum. But they, we talked about in the past, what was your airspeed coming in versus your regular airspeed? And they had to come in hot. They had to come in fast to keep that plane flying.
Yeah.
And as soon as they touch down the nose wheel, which is controlled by your rudder pedals, the nose wheel tried to veer off the runway. I mean, it was unbelievable. he talks about there was one lady passenger. She said, boy, if I could, I would love to give you a big kiss right now. And John said, I don't think there's anything that were in the rules against that. But both crews that were on board that 747, they did a remarkable job. And he tells a story tonight and tomorrow at 3 o'clock at the Wings of the North Museum at Flying Cloud Airport. There was a great documentary that was made about that flight, and John Hansen was interviewed extensively for that. And that'll be shown at that.
Oh, wow.
And then John will open it up for questions. So anybody who wants to do that can do that. So
well, that'd be fascinating. Yeah. And fun. Bill, how big a plane or how small a plane do you fly into the mountains and over in the mountain range there in Colorado? Is that dangerous with a small plane, or is 12,000 feet not that much to go above?
Well, there's a certain elevation where you have to have oxygen, you have to have pressurization in your airplane, or you have to have portable oxygen, a small tank for the pilot to be able to, be clear-headed.
Yep.
There's a lot of us that don't like to fly over the mountains in small airplanes because if something goes wrong, not a lot of places to land.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Do they fly a lot in and out of there or not?
Oh, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
You see planes going over. A lot of planes will go up to, Winter Park in that area, Vail, Breckenridge, Steamboat. They all have their own airports. And so, they do it.
Yep.
It's better to have a little bigger airplane, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
And you want to have that pressurization. That was, Mike, the interview that you just did, that was fascinating. I didn't realize such young guys were playing that level of basketball.
Oh, in Minnesota,
impressive.
For some reason this year, there is a group of eighth graders at big schools and small schools that are really playing at a high level. I mean, starters at Wayzata and Minnehaha and Minneapolis North, good teams,
Huh.
Things have changed,
Well, they have. Yeah, they have. I mean, when I was at Richfield, that was sophomore.
Unheard of,
senior,
right?
And yeah. They were in junior high.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You want to carry my books to the game? Fine, kid, but that's about it. Hey, Al, we got to go, but I look forward to what will be a fascinating interview coming up on aviation.
Thanks, Mike.
Always good. Al Malmberg, having a great weekend, taking you into the weekend. Great to have him in the fold. He's up next on News Radio 830 WCCO.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.